The Soldiers of God on the March in Iran.
Terrorist attack in southeastern Iran has killed scores of people, including several senior officers of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, the IRGC.
More than 40 people dead in Iran, militant attacks continue in Pakistan, and more U.S. soldiers dead in Afghanistan. Does anyone believe they're really fighting for God? Honoring the fallen, trying to understand the violence on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, October 19th. I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry.
Good morning, Celeste. Coming up this hour, Senate Democrats huddle at the White House over health care reform. A weekend of blowouts in the NFL. We'll recap a scoreboard with 48-27. Saints beat Giants 59-0. Patriots over the Titans, but it was the Titans. And could Where the Wild Things Are actually work as a parenting guide?
But first, let's go to Jonathan Marcus, diplomatic correspondent for our partner, the BBC. So a group called Soldiers of God is claiming responsibility for that suicide bombing in Iran that killed at least 42 people over the weekend. And we appear now to be facing instability in Iran, Pakistan, and Afghanistan. So Jonathan, how much of a worry should this be for the West?
Well, obviously, Pakistan is in a sense, the central worry. Pakistan and Afghanistan combined, the insurrectionary movements inside Iran pose a rather different kind of problem. Obviously, the Obama administration and the West in general are trying to encourage the Iranians into dialogue, and I think that's why you've seen the various expressions from a number of Western governments of unease and concern for what has happened in Iran. It's not in anyone's interest that Iran suffers the kind of domestic terrorism that we see in Afghanistan and indeed in Pakistan.
Okay, we're going to talk about that more with Jonathan Marcus in just a moment. But first, everything else you need to know this morning.
Well, in the headlines, less than an hour from now, diplomats from Russia, France, and the U.S. will begin talks with Iran on its nuclear program. Iranian state media reports that Tehran is backing away from a proposal from the United Nations to send its enriched uranium abroad for modifications. White House Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel says there will be no decision on troop levels in Afghanistan until the presidential election there is settled. He also says that the new Afghan government must be deemed a, quote, true partner of the United States.
It could be a while before that happens because the Afghan Election Commission today says it won't accept the findings of a panel backed by the United Nations. Two officials from that panel have concluded the runoff will be needed. An attorney for Richard and Mayumi Heaney says the couple is willing to voluntarily turn themselves in to face any charges stemming from an alleged hoax. A Colorado sheriff says the report that their six-year-old floated away in a giant balloon was a publicity stunt. Wall Street was down a little bit on Friday. Dow is going to kick off at 99.96, back below that 10,000 mark. The S&P will start trading at 10.88, and the NASDAQ begins at 21.57. So it looks like one of our listeners, Nesta, agrees with you, John. She writes on the website, Max of Where the Wild Things Are and Falcon Heaty, I just don't understand the hype. But the truth is that as soon as you become a parent, whether it's from your mother-in-law, from your neighbors, from your school, you're going to get unasked for advice from somebody. And our question today is, when does that happen? When is it okay? And when does it become a problem? Backseat parenting. 8778-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytakeatthetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Our government.
Iran.
Your government.
Proliferation.
Public option.
A serious insurgency.
We do have a plan. We're working on it.
Just to give you a sense of perspective. Oh, what's going on? What's going on?
Good morning. It's Monday. That means it's time to check out what's on the agenda for this week.
There needed to be something about Balloon Boy in there, Jay. Why wasn't that in there? There needed to be a Balloon Boy voice.
You really
in there.
Want the Balloon Boy and no. the permanent music for
but,
the agenda?
But it's certainly open season on the Heaneys, right? Everyone's going to be parenting their children for the next, like, 30 years, right?
Sir, I mean, we're both parents, John. Yeah. I mean, the fact of the matter is, it feels to me, and maybe this is just me as a single mom, but it feels to me as, like, as soon as you become a parent, it's open season on you.
As soon as you leave the house and anybody sees, you know,
you bring bring the baby home, right, and exactly. You're toast.
Well,
that's
The Heaney's got some problems, that's for sure.
That's right. And we're asking other parents. Call in at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. This is my question for you. At what point does second-guessing become a problem? Because the Heaney's invited the world into their home, but the world comes into your home and every time you bring your kids over to a neighbor's or you have a birthday party at home. So when does that become a problem, this backseat parenting, the armchair quarterbacking for parents? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org. But this morning, we're going to talk about the agenda for the week. And we have to go to Iran this morning. Just this morning, the chief of Iran's Revolutionary Guard is accusing the United States, Britain, and Pakistan of having links with the Sunni militants responsible for that suicide bombing that killed 5 senior guard commanders and 37 other people. So we're joined by Marcus Mabry, international business editor for our partner, the New York Times. And Jonathan Marcus rejoins us, the diplomatic correspondent for our partner, the BBC. Jonathan, good morning.
Good morning.
So a group called the Soldiers of God, which is a Sunni Muslim militant group, has claimed responsibility for the attacks. But as I said before, the chief of Iran's Revolutionary Guard is accusing the U.S. and Britain and even Pakistan of funding this group and being behind these terrorist attacks. Is this plausible?
Well, it's certainly a claim the Iranians have made many times before, and usually, actually, it's the British government that is the chief evildoer, allegedly, according to the Iranians. There's no apparent evidence, obviously, that Western countries or indeed even Pakistan necessarily have been backing these groups, though, of course, they operate close to Pakistan's border. I think, in a sense, there's a broader problem here with the plausibility of these sorts of claims, especially inside Iran itself, and that is obviously that when you've had governments abroad, notably the Bush administration, pushing very hard for what is in effect a regime change policy in Iran, then of course the plausibility that of such stories, of such claims does, I suppose, tend to grow. It's interesting that the Obama administration has pretty well, I think, clearly given up with the idea of regime change inside Iran. It will be interesting to see how these sorts of claims play out there now, not least because obviously the Iranian authorities themselves are not terribly popular in the wake of the contested elections.
Is the intended audience for these kind of claims, when Iran blames the U.S. and Britain, are they really just trying to speak to their own people? Is that who they're trying to convince?
I think they are. I think there is inevitably a tendency when these things happen to try and get everybody to rally around with a national spirit. I mean, this is not obviously the first attack of this kind, though it's a particularly serious one. And it just simply adds to the Iranian authorities' problems at this time. So I think the message is essentially, it's a defiant message vis-a-vis the outside world, but I think the message is essentially for domestic consumption.
Okay, we're going to talk more about Iran later this hour, but Jonathan, let's move to Pakistan. This is the third day of the Pakistani army's offensive against al-Qaeda and Taliban in South Waziristan. Is the government making progress here?
It's very hard to say. There aren't a lot of detailed reports from the ground. This is an offensive that has been heralded for many weeks now. And indeed, it's clear, I think, that the other side sought to get their retaliation in first with this wave of bomb attacks and so on inside Pakistan itself. It's going to be very, very difficult, this offensive, and I'm not entirely sure that there is going to be a clear-cut outcome. The terrain is very difficult. These are essentially lawless areas where the writ of the Pakistan government doesn't run. I think there are concerns about the capabilities and capacities of Pakistan's armed forces. And, of course, caught up in all of this are huge numbers of civilians, many of whom have fled their homes, which, again, adds an additional burden for the authorities in Islamabad that they have to deal with.
You know, we have this violence in Pakistan. We've had the bombings in Iran. And Marcus Mabry, we have obviously the ongoing situation in Afghanistan, and the news now is that there was so much fraud in the election that Hamid Karzai did not get more than 50% of the vote. There will be a runoff, and here was Senator John Kerry on Face the Nation yesterday.
I don't see how President Obama can make a decision about the committing of our additional forces or even the further fulfillment of our mission that's here today without an adequate government in place or knowledge about what that government's going to be.
So Marcus, with our partner, the New York Times, what does this mean? Does this mean that the White House, the Barack Obama's White House, may be buying more time, that we may have to wait for a decision on troop levels until a runoff election is held?
Well, the administration said very clearly that they will. They're going to wait until there's actual an election outcome in Afghanistan.
Very clearly? The administration also said negotiated settlement. They were all over the map on this. Mm-hmm. Jerome Emanuel was talking about maybe there'll be an election, maybe there won't. They're going to wait for something.
Well, you know,
that's clear.
You know, it's interesting. Even Abdullah, the likely competitor in the runoff with Karzai, has himself come out and said that, oh, well, if they say that there'll be another election, maybe we won't have to do it. Maybe I would be willing if they just say that, you know, that I would be the candidate who would be in that runoff election. I might be willing myself to actually join a unity government. Mm. So the Afghanis, the Afghanis have not made it clear themselves what kind of situation they want here as they try to evolve into a more plausible polity. At the same time, the administration has got to kind of sit back now and see what's going to happen before they can make a troop commitment. I think what's really scary here is you look at Afghanistan, you now see this arc of instability. And Afghanistan is kind of in the middle of this arc, but this arc stretches really from a likely to be, if not already, nuclear-armed, instable Iran to a nuclear-armed, as we already know, an instable Pakistan with Afghanistan between the two. It is an incredibly scary arc of instability, soon to be a nuclear-armed arc of instability.
And the U.S. is engaged in all three at various levels.
Absolutely, at different levels in all three, and not with actually a plausible policy in any of the three cases. So the likelihood that this administration will actually be able to make great progress in any of those countries in that arc of instability, that nuclear arc of instability, is incredibly unlikely in the next 3 years of this administration. And that's what I think most scary, both for Washington, but also for our allies in Europe.
Maybe that's the new takeaway. Instead of axis of evil, arc of instability. Marcus Mabry coined it right here on our show, arc of instability. I like that.
Well, we need to talk quickly about health care reform because the White House came out swinging this weekend. Clearly, any good feeling between the White House and insurance companies is over. But the White House, at the same time that they're saying don't let the insurance companies ruin what we're doing so well, that the White House is saying that they're making really good progress.
We are farther along than we've ever been in passing a comprehensive health insurance reform in this country. It's something we've discussed for 100 years.
That's White House Senior Advisor David Axelrod on George Stephanopoulos' program. So,
sounds like he's declaring victory there.
Exactly. That's right.
It's a little premature.
You take your victories where you can, perhaps.
So, Marcus, victory at the same time that we're warning that it could be derailed by the insurance industry.
Well, you know, they have to do that. The administration had to decide early on who were they going to actually assail in this fight for health care reform. There are so many constituents, so many different players when it comes to healthcare reform. You have the insurance companies, you have big pharma, the pharmaceutical companies, who charge much more in this country than any other developed country in the world because we let them. Other countries actually set price controls for their drugs. Europe does it all over the place. We do not do it in the U.S., and so they make a great deal more money here than they do in other modern democracies, other rich countries. So they had to decide who to take on. The administration decided we're going to take on insurance companies. We're going to make deals with doctors, hospitals, big pharma, and vilify the insurance companies. Well, the insurance companies, not surprisingly, don't agree with that, taking them on, so they're going to try to fight back. It's going to be interesting to see if we have a deal that emerges, a single Senate program that emerges with the single not the single payer option, excuse me, that merges with a public option, meaning a government control that can government program that can compete with private insurers. It's interesting to see if it comes out of the Senate. It really seems unlikely, but the House, it will definitely have it in their version. So it's going to be a Democrat versus Democrat fight here.
Okay, Marcus Magri with our partner, the New York Times. We also spoke with Jonathan Marcus, with our diplomatic correspondent for our partner, the BBC. And Marcus, you have twins on the way, right?
I do have twins on the way.
Are you prepared for the vaccine? Parenting? You ready to take all the advice on how to become a parent?
Well, I got to tell you.
That seems clear. You understand that.
If we, you know, tell the whole world that one of those twins has gone up in a balloon and he hasn't, and we've concocted the whole scheme, and we expect the 6-year-old twin to keep the lie. Well,
yeah, I wouldn't do the balloon thing the first couple months.
Back seat me. Yeah.
Right. Thanks, Jonathan Marcus and Marcus Mabry.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
Hey, get your takeouts, get your takeouts. We got some stories we want you to stay on top of this week, and we begin with Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, back from a week off. Good morning, Todd.
Hey, John, good morning.
So how are those negotiations on the health care reform bill with the most powerful Democrat in the Senate, Olympia Snowe, and everyone else on Capitol Hill?
Yeah, well, you know how this has been going. It comes out into the open, then back behind the scenes, then out into the open. Now it's back behind the scenes again as three very powerful senators try to figure out what exactly is going to be in the bill that reaches the Senate floor.
Is Olympia Snowe the most powerful Democrat in the Senate right now? She's a Republican?
So, you know, a lot of the Republicans call her Rhino. I think we've said that on the show before. Rhino, Republican in name only. That's some of the hardcore Republicans refer to her that way. That's for them, I guess. These conversations have moved into a triumvirate of Democrats trying to figure out what is going to be in the bill. And of course, we've been harping on the public option. It's not the only issue. They got to figure out how to pay for this $900 billion bill. They have to figure out who's going to be taxed, Cadillac insurance plans or drug companies. But then also, of course, the public option. And moderate Democrats may be warming up to the idea of having a public option. Listen to Kent Conrad from North Dakota. He's been a major critic of the public option, and this is a nuanced statement, but listen to him from Fox News Sunday yesterday.
Of course, Olympia Snowe has proposed a triggered mechanism, so if the other reforms in the bill aren't as successful as we hope, that a public option would be triggered down the line, but not one, and I want to emphasize this again, not one tied to Medicare levels of reimbursement. That is unacceptable and could not get the votes.
What's he talking about, Medicare levels of reimbursement? What's that issue?
Okay, the debate has quietly shifted on Capitol Hill. There are different ways to do a public option. One is you tie the payments to doctors, hospitals, everybody else, to Medicare rates plus some percent, 5%, Medicare plus 5, they call it in shorthand.
And that would be a net reduction in rates, right?
For most doctors and hospitals,
right, exactly.
It would. And for Conrad's people in North Dakota, it would be a huge reduction because reimbursement rates in his state are low. That's why he's so against it. The other way to do it is to base a public option on negotiated rates the same way private insurance negotiates now. Everybody gets a little more money. The taxpayer doesn't save nearly as much, but it's still something you can call a public option. And the interesting thing about what he said is that the question now seems to be becoming not if a public option is going to get out of the Senate, but what that public option will look like. You have Conrad, who's the most vocal backer of using co-ops, not public option, saying, I could be for it, but not tied to Medicare. So I'll tell you how important this is. The White House is paying attention. Conrad meets one-on-one with the president this afternoon at 4 o'clock.
Oh, that's the big headline. Thank you very much. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, the state of healthcare in the backroom dealings on Capitol Hill. Thanks, Todd.
So now on to sports with our sports contributor, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. It was a very good day for football fans yesterday, right? The big story is the New Orleans Saints went into the game undefeated, but their opponent was also undefeated. What happened?
Well, yesterday, the Giants lost to the New Orleans Saints.
Crushed.
40,
yeah.
You said killing, crushed, smashed,
trampled.
Yeah, all those adjectives. 48-7. And if you think
48
about
48 to 27.
48-27. Yeah. If you think about both of those two cities, New Orleans and New York, if you go anywhere in the world, people know where those places are. They have a very distinct identity. So you take a guy like Eli Manning, who's from New Orleans. I went to homecoming this weekend. It was a homecoming for Eli Manning. My team lost in a homecoming, and him on the Giants, they got destroyed. And part of the reason why was that Drew Brees is the best quarterback in the NFL, and I've said it here before. He's unbelievable. And they exploited the Giants' weaknesses, which includes a very weak linebacker core. And we've been thinking about this all year long. Their linebackers are not able to get it done, and it was truly exposed. They had all these puff opponents for the past couple of weeks, but they just crushed those linebackers.
So Brett Favre also demonstrating that an old guy can still do it in the
NFL.
Another
guy from New Orleans.
It's a 44-yard try, left hash, snap, good, spot down, right-footed kick is up, and it is no good! No good! He missed it wide left, and there's another Minneapolis miracle!
That was from the Minnesota Viking games against the Baltimore Ravens yesterday. Brett Favre is doing well.
For real. They were up most of the game. The Vikings had, it seemed like they had it easy. And then, of course, Baltimore came back, and Joe Flacco, he's, you know, the second-year quarterback. He came back. He brought the Baltimore Ravens back, and they got a 33-31 lead going into the last 3 minutes and 37 seconds. Brett Favre threw a 58-yard pass to set up the game-winning field goal. 58-yard pass to this guy, Sidney Rice. That's why they brought Brett Favre into Minnesota.
Vikings are undefeated 33-31 over the Baltimore Ravens. That's amazing.
Unbelievable.
Heartbreaker.
We also saw Tom Brady setting another veteran quarterback, but he set a record yesterday, broke a record. Here's that.
Brady takes the snap, looks, rifles it right. Welker, touchdown. Tom Brady has thrown 5 first-half touchdown passes.
Now, he 5 touchdown passes, but he was playing the Tennessee Titans.
He was playing the Tennessee Titans in the October Snow Bowl.
Small T.
In the middle of a blizzard in New England in October. You really expect Tennessee to actually play any good football? I don't think so. Especially when they're 0-5, now they're 0-6. Brady threw for 380 yards. He has 6 touchdowns, 5 touchdowns in one quarter. Randy Moss had 3 touchdowns himself. It was a beautiful game if you're a New England fan, and a sad, sad day for the Tennessee Titans.
Yeah, and sad for the Jets, too. They rush for over 300 yards and still lose the game.
That's a record. 5 interceptions for Mark Sanchez. Ouch.
Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports contributor. Thanks.
Hey, good morning.
Our last takeout comes from you, the listeners. On Friday's show, we talked about the controversial sheriff in Arizona, Joe Arpaio. He was stripped of his powers to enforce immigration rules due to a change in federal law. Then in protest, he announced that he would conduct anti-illegal immigrant sweeps anyway. We talked about that on the show, and you had a lot of things to say about that. There was cheering and jeering. Teresa wrote, "Go, go, Sheriff Joe," while MK Ultra called Sheriff Arpaio a putrid excuse for a human being. Someone named Buff Rat says, "I welcome people of all shapes, sizes, ethnic backgrounds, color, etc. to this wonderful country, but they need to come in the front door. Those that don't violate our laws tax our schools and health systems, and the sheriff's actions are according to law." Well, Chris responds, "People seem to think illegal immigrants take all of Social Security, health care, and other benefits. The fact is that the low percentage of illegals in America, less than 5% of the population, don't stress the system nearly as hard as the people it was designed to control, the middle class." You, of course, can join this lively, fiery back and forth at thetakeaway.org. We started a new series on Friday with our friend Farai Chidea about values, rethinking what we value as human beings now that the economy has changed so much. We've been getting your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Ryan in Detroit, just wanted to say that this economy has made me focus even more on investing, changing, going down a different road.
And Old Heathen commented on our website, "Family, friends, and neighbors, they all matter more than money. I've known this since the 80s when I reached my 20s. Money plays into this only the extent that our system is focused on money." And let us know how your values have shaped, your recession has shaped your values at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. Just keep the responses coming. We love to hear from you.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, what's behind that suicide bombing that killed at least 42 people in Iran? Religious tensions or covert Western operations? That's just ahead. First, let's check in on the top news stories at 32 minutes after the hour. Pakistan is pressing ahead with an assault on Al-Qaeda and Taliban sanctuaries close to the Afghan border. The fighting takes place as General David Petraeus meets with Pakistan's prime minister and army chief in the capital, Islamabad. Meanwhile, the Pakistani government is closing schools in Islamabad and other major cities because of security concerns. Our partner, the BBC, reports there are worries the schools could be targets for militants.
The White House will not decide on troop levels in Afghanistan until there's an outcome in the presidential election there. Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel tells CNN it would be reckless not to wait.
The question does not come how many troops you send, but do you have a credible Afghan partner for this process that can provide the security and the type of services the Afghan people need.
Today, the Afghan commission charged with declaring a winner in that country's election is rejecting an investigation of voter fraud. Officials who worked on the United Nations-backed probe say that incumbent President Hamid Karzai did not get enough votes to avoid a runoff. And back in the U.S., Colorado authorities say the Heaneys will probably face felony charges for saying their son floated away in a homemade balloon. Those are some of the news stories we're following this morning.
Joining us now is Professor Hamid Debashi, professor of Iranian studies at Columbia University, to talk about this story over the weekend. A suicide bomber killed at least 42 people in Iran near the Pakistani border, including five senior commanders of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, the deadliest attack against this elite unit since February 2007. Professor Debashi, good morning.
Good morning, John.
First of all, the early reports suggest this is a faction of Sunni Islam versus the predominantly Shiite power structure inside Iran. Can you describe to us what is the history of Sunni-Shia tensions in Iran? We're certainly much more familiar with that in Iraq.
Well, the origin of it, John, is quite old. It goes back to 16th century when under the Safavid Empire, Shiism becomes official state religion. And there is either massive conversion from Sunnism to Shiism, or else some Iranian Sunnis just move out, go to Mughal India. But it's now ancient history. What you have today is 95% of Iran are Shiis. And there are small Sunni minorities, some of them in this particular province, southeastern Iran, in Sistan and Balochistan, and also some other minorities, for example, in Kurdistan in the west. There is this army, which is called a terrorist organization, guerrilla operation, depends how you look at them.
Jundala, right? This is the Jundala group?
Jundala, the right. Army of God, they right. call themselves. And they have been quite active in southeastern Iran. Reports are that they might be connected to some elements in Pakistan, as Ahmadinejad said yesterday. And there are also reports that they might have been connected to other separatist movements. But the origin of them is quite old, and the overwhelming majority of people in Sistan and Balochistan are Sunnis. But, you know, they have also lived in peace in the
right.
past. Now, this is quite a new phenomenon.
Well, the interesting part is that the history goes back so long that it would be hard to imagine that these Sunni groups have a particular political mission inside Iran. I'm wondering if the way to analyze this is that the instability of the Ahmadinejad government has created an opportunity for groups like this to attack.
That's an excellent point, John, quite so. But the origin of these sorts of separatist movements go back. And in fact, the Speaker of the House immediately blamed the United States for this. And this may refer back to a comment made by Congresswoman Jane Harman made back in March about there are minorities in Iran and that the United States in so far as the question of nuclear arms is concerned, has to put pressure on Iran by way of precisely these sorts of separatist movements.
And there is precedent for that. I mean, the U.S. has supported separatist groups and various sort of ethnic minorities inside Iran
very
at various points.
So. Yeah. Very much so. And then, again, back in July, Congresswoman Dana Rohrabacher, in a congressional hearing, again insisted that there should be covert operations. So they are not completely conspiratorial, Iranians, when referred to American involvement. But your point about the lack of stability of Ahmadinejad and even legitimacy, because there are millions of Iranians who believe this past presidential election was flawed, is a key factor in these sorts of movement. And in fact, this could have a very chilling effect on that movement, because right now, the leading conservative newspapers in Tehran are also blaming Israel, which is a key signal that they're going to crack down on oppositional movements that they always accuse of having connection with Israel.
On some level, is it possible that this is a test of the point the finger at the great Satan, whether it is Britain, whether it's the U.S., whether it is Israel, a test of the credibility of that argument with the Iranian people right now?
Well, the test of that argument, John, was back in after the presidential election, that this so-called Velvet Revolution was also attributed to Americans. But to the best of my knowledge and judgment, that doesn't wash anymore. That is, you have had a mass inbred and grassroots civil rights movement in Iran. 80% of the Iranian population is under the age of 40, 70% under the age of 30. They simply don't buy that anymore. So the problem that they have on their hand is more serious. But these sorts of agitations that happen around Iran, that nobody knows who is responsible for them. The Jundullah has not officially accepted responsibility. It is the official Iranian news organizations that say. But a number of, as you said in your beginning, there is the number of quite high-ranking Pasdaran Iranian militia that have been killed in this. So the situation is quite intense, particularly in the last comments that Ahmadinejad said that Pakistan may have had something to do with this. And given the chaos that is now happening in northern Pakistan because of President Obama's pressure on Pakistan to root out the Taliban, this could be an ominous sign of the extension of that sort of a Talibanization of northern Pakistan into eastern Iran, which means even more trouble.
Professor Dabashi, you said that the electorate, the people of Iran, aren't buying it when they blame it on the U.S., Britain, and pretty much most of the Western countries. Well, I think people were surprised at how sophisticated they were in the protests in the last election. Do we think that this sophisticated electorate is going to buy into terrorist attacks against the government as a form of protest?
Absolutely not. In fact, I've been monitoring the press over the last 24 hours, and the right-wing press, the press connected with the government, is drumming it up like there is no tomorrow, and in fact, the reformist press is not mentioning a single item about what happened in Sistan and Balochistan.
Well, that's interesting.
And they're very busy getting ready for a mass rally on 5th of November, which is called the Day of the Student, and as if nothing has happened in Balochistan.
Well, plenty of takeaways there. A suggestion of a Talibanization of the entire South Asian region from Iran all the way to Afghanistan. That's Professor Hamid Dabashi, professor of Iranian studies at Columbia University, talking about the aftermath in Iran of a suicide bombing over the weekend that killed 42. We're going to go to Where the Wild Things Are as a parenting class in just a moment.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. You know, before it was a blockbuster movie, Where the Wild Things Are was a classic kid's fable about an unruly boy and his mom, a fable about parenting. And I think it's fair to say that the wild story of the Heenies, a balloon, and their kids is also a parenting fable, or maybe it's a cautionary tale altogether.
Well, it could be very easy to criticize the Heenies if they actually did use their son Falcon to score a reality TV show. And you might also disagree, by the way, with how Max's mom in that book disciplined her child just for being what he is naturally, which is a wild boy. We're going to be talking about that more in a few minutes.
But you've been telling us your stories all day. You've been reacting to this, like the difference between raising boys and girls.
This is Mike from Wayne. Growing up, my mom said that I wasn't one of those wild boys, but I've got three daughters, and my two youngest act like wild boys. And some of the things they do and say, I could swear I have boys. So I'm not sure if it's strictly gender-related or if it's really personality-based.
This is Heather from Detroit. I'm lucky enough to have my mom working at the school where my son goes, and not a day goes by that I don't get a phone call about what could be wrong with him.
Why is it politically correct to say that boys are different? Surely they are, but by definition that clearly means that girls are different. But it's less politically correct to say that. And why was it politically incorrect in that case for ex-president of Harvard, Larry Summers, to have said that maybe one of the reasons statistically why women are less representative in engineering and the sciences is because of some inherent preferences that they may have?
Yes, I think Larry Summers would rather be back at Harvard rather than in the Obama administration.
We're also getting
let's get Summers back to Harvard. That's good.
We're also getting a lot of reactions to a blog post by our friend David Wall Rice on our website, thetakeaway.org. In his piece, David writes, Max from Where the Wild Things Are is someone I know. Surely the balloon boy knows him too, and don't we all? That vexed kid wanting to wild out, but also wanting a safe dinner. The trick is to keep this childlike impulsive id in check. So sometimes being wild just means being who you are without the need to medicate the problem.
My name is Laura from Manhattan. I am a special ed teacher at a junior senior high school, and I deal with kids every day who have ADHD and are on medication. And for some students, it works great, and for some students, it's just a simple case of over-medication and other methods need to be researched by parents.
resourced by a parent. I love the 21st century. So we're also getting your take on Balloon Boy and what that says about his parents, if it is true that they were using the incident for some kind of gain. Lori writes to us and calls herself proud mother of seven, not famous children. She emails us at thetakeaway.org. We continue to tune in to watch parents starved for attention, John and Kate, Extreme Makeover, and others who shamelessly self-promote themselves. Now we wonder why some wacko in Denver would pull such a stunt. Duh. Turn off your television and parent your children from the heart.
Also, Russ writes on our website, there's nothing real about reality TV families, so backseat parenting doesn't enter into it. That's an interesting take on the whole thing. What is your story? And also, answer our question today. When is it okay to second-guess a parent? When is it okay to give them advice, whether they've asked for it or very often have not asked for it? The number is 8778-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
It's always okay.
Really?
Yeah.
So I mean, I can talk about how clean your children's room was the other night?
Yeah. What? Do you have a problem with that?
It was pretty messy.
Your son helped to mess it up, by the way, when he was over there. Tell us your story at 8778-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. We're really getting into some deep issues here. I think that's good.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headley here with John Hockenberry. So if you are a parent of a small boy and maybe the weather was bad over the weekend like it was here, and you are locked inside an apartment with a small boy, maybe you know exactly where the wild things are. They're in your home. We're going to talk about that in just a moment. But having where the wild things are and the story of the balloon boy in the news at the same time has us asking for your thoughts about backseat parenting. From how we judge how Max in that story is disciplined to the alleged hoax by the family in Denver, how do you handle armchair parenting?
I'm the parent of a child with autism. Just last week, my wife was in a health food store and was accosted by the manager, who chased her around the store for 10 minutes, telling her that we were making a choice by not medically treating our child's autism in the Jenny McCarthy fashion. And he resisted every attempt my wife made to rebuff him.
When is it okay to do that yourself? Call us with your take at 8778-MY-TAKE. But first, here's a check on the leading stories at 48 minutes after the hour. New federal guidelines come out today on medical marijuana. The Justice Department is expected to direct its agents not to go after suppliers or those who take the drug for medicinal purposes in the 14 states where it's legal. That's a complete reversal of Bush administration policy. And there are more talks today between Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid and the White House on the Senate's plan for reform. They're trying to finalize a bill with the aim of sending it to the full Senate this week.
In Pakistan, troops are fighting militants on three fronts along the Afghan border, with fighter jets bombing insurgent positions in the region. Comes as the U.S. is backing that offensive. Senator John Kerry and General David Petraeus are in Pakistan today meeting with top officials. And those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Pull out of the shadows and find that eventually there we are, where we are, and what we are is still family.
It's Monday. That's the day that we talk about family on The Takeaway. We've decided to continue a conversation you started last week about where the wild things are. And if you're a parent, you already know that, like it or not, say what you will, boys are just different than girls.
I like the way you destroy stuff. Good technique. There's a spark to your work that can't be taught.
Thanks.
That doesn't need to come from the movie. That could be Saturday morning at my house. Joining us to talk about raising boys is Lisa Belkin, author of the New York Times parenting blog, Motherload. Good morning, Lisa.
Good morning.
So how often does this question come up? People who see boys being very energetic, often destructive, and they wonder whether or not it's normal.
Well, every time you see a boy being destructive, you wonder whether it's normal. I mean, every time you see your child do much of anything, you wonder whether it's normal. And what was interesting about the movie is that, who knew? This book is a parenting primer. It's an instruction on how one way to handle it the right way.
We've had a number of responses from listeners. Carol wrote to thetakeaway.org, I have to believe that even for my own three boys, often wild, despite my efforts, when it comes to right and wrong, it's about teaching them what they will remember and what will stop them in their tracks when faced with the opportunity to do otherwise. We're also joined by Michelle Seaton, co-author of The Way of Boys, Raising Healthy Boys in a Challenging and Complex World. And the other author of that book is Anthony Rayo, child psychologist. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
So,
good morning.
Michelle, this issue came up for you in a very personal way. What happened with your son?
Shortly after my son turned 3, his preschool teacher sat me down and said flat out, he is not developing normally. He's not developing. He's not making enough eye contact.
What was her issue?
He's not talking enough. He's not interacting with his peers enough, and you need to contact the public school system and get him tested right now. He needs intervention right now.
And you got him tested.
We did get him tested. I was scared out of my mind.
Of course you were.
That if he, you know, if he's behind now, what's going to happen later? And I think a lot of mothers feel this way. We did get him tested by the school system, and we did what the preschool teacher did. We called them and said, he has a problem. He has a disorder. You've got to test him right now. And it wasn't shouldn't be too surprising that they did decide that he had a disorder. He got an IEP. He was put into a special preschool designed to help him be more normal, and it wasn't until many months later that we were able to get him in to see a pediatric neurologist who evaluated him and then said to me, get this kid out of my office. There's nothing wrong with him.
And you eventually contacted Dr. Tony Rayo.
Yes, who has an incredible perspective on this kind of development and this kind of thing that's happening all over the place and exactly how to parent boys to get their attention and to understand their development.
So, Tony Rayo, you heard our takeaway contributor, Lisa Belkin, talking about how often this comes up with her. You're a child psychologist. How often do you get questions from parents who feel like their boys are out of control?
Oh, it's all the time. You know, just looking at how boys are such an easy target to get diagnosed, you know, they are diagnosed at least 3 times more than girls for ADHD, and that has gone up tremendously over a recent 10-year period, and it's the most common pediatric problem now in the United States. Only here do we have pediatricians worried about ADHD as something that's happening during the, you know, the 10, 15 minutes that you're lucky to get time with your pediatrician. Now we got bipolar disorder being diagnosed. It's increased 4,000% in a 10-year period, along with antipsychotics being used in youth and adolescents and very young kids. But predominantly, hands down, it's boys who get these diagnoses and these medications.
You know, I myself have an 11-year-old boy, and a very close friend of mine has 2 girls who are very girly and prim. And every time he would have a play date at their house, he would be running around like a savage around their house. And their dad would look at me and say, what is wrong with your kid? And I would have to explain to him that there really is a difference in energy levels and play styles of boys and girls.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Actually, from day one, boys just move more than girls. You know, in infant research, they show that. They don't make as good eye contact. Their social skills are not as well developed. They don't get their first words. Their vocabulary is less than girls. By the time they reach school, they're about a year behind in some of the social, emotional, and certainly the language areas. And all those things are really a setup for when we put them into longer school days. We ask them to do more when they're younger. They need to be outdoors more. They need to be more active. And when they're indoors, they're going to be like Max. They're going to, you know, they're going to romp around. They're going to chase the dog. They're going to, you know, I'm going to go on record here and just say, hey, this is, you know, this is a boy who, you know, would have been diagnosed back in 1963. That's when the book was published with, you know, ADHD.
Well, but Lisa Belkin, takeaway contributor, author of the Motherload blog at our partner, the New York Times. I mean, is that to say that the alternative is to send active boys to an island with a lot of really huge furry creatures as opposed to diagnosing them with ADHD and giving them antipsychotic drugs?
Well, sometimes some parents would like to. I think that one of the messages here is that if the system doesn't work for 50% of your population, then maybe there's something a little bit wrong with the system. The other message here is the way the mom in this story handles it. I mean, people are always writing to me to say, okay, I know what I'm not supposed to do. I'm not supposed to scream, and I'm not supposed to spank, and I'm not supposed to restrain, and I'm not, but what am I supposed to do? And in this film, what mom does is send the boy who is acting out, the wild boy, to his room.
So Lisa and Michelle, I'm going to ask you the same question. Our takeaway question today is about backseat parenting, because everyone gets backseat parented, right? I mean, your mother-in-law, your neighbors, your teachers, obviously, Michelle.
Yep.
So Lisa, let me ask you, I'll have you answer this first, and then Michelle, how do you advise people to handle armchair parenting?
Well, I noticed when you told your story, you were at a friend's house, and the friend's father, the kid's father, said, "Why is your son acting like that?" So, yeah, everybody feels entitled to their opinion. And we are so unsure of ourselves in this department that we have to pick apart everyone else's. The solution is certainty in what you're doing, but we don't have that. Short of that, I'm not sure of the solution.
Well, Michelle, how did you handle it when you went back to the school and you did not put him on medication anymore? How did you handle the comments?
Well, he was taken out of that school. He's one of those boys that we talk about who was expelled from a certain preschool and didn't go back there. But I, you know, what I think of for mothers, you just need to know that your son is okay in your heart. And what I like about this, the time out or the time away, and what Max's mother does for him, is that you're handling it in your own way, and you're teaching your son. You're putting him in his room, and you're teaching him to control his own behavior. You're teaching him to control his own emotions. I think that's what you're doing. You have to know that you are helping your son learn the skills that he needs to learn, regardless of how he's behaving.
So I guess that's the takeaway, teaching these boys how to handle themselves. Michelle Seaton and Anthony Rayo co-authored the book, The Way of Boys, Raising Healthy Boys in a Challenging and Complex World. We're also joined by Lisa Belkin, takeaway contributor and author of the Family and Parenting blog at our partner, The New York Times. So boys, girls, other wild things, we want to hear your parenting stories. When is it okay to second-guess parents? Only when they're on TV or in the grocery store, as one person was saying. Give us a call at 8778-MYTAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
I think you want to know more about Maurice Sendak's relationship with his mom, you know.
did she give him time
was
away?
Was it just
you mean?
A timeout? Was that as simple as it was? And we're also, you know, talking about chili. It's getting chilly outside. This coming Wednesday, we're going to hold a chili cook-off. I've got some great recipes. Here's the deal. Send us your tried and true recipe for chili con carne or the veggie style. It's a recession, so make it on the cheap. Email that to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway. Afghanistan's President Hamid Karzai has a vision.
The vision for Afghanistan 15 years from now is to be much less dependent on the international community. In other words, not to be a burden on you the way we are today.
It's heavy. Lay your burden down.
The burden of Afghanistan includes no legitimate elected president months after the troubled election. Hamid Karzai says only 15 more years. What does the Obama administration say? We're still waiting to hear on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from WNYC and PRI.
The burden of Afghanistan. Good morning. It's Monday, October 19th. I'm John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, John. Coming up, the burden of reality TV. It's the balloon boy uncertainty principle. Can we stare at kids on reality TV without somehow changing them? That's the question. In baseball, it was a very rough weekend for both the West Coast teams. Are we in for a New York Philly face-off in the World Series?
An I-95 World Series. But first, Ambassador Peter Galbraith joins us. He was until last month the number two ranking official at the United Nations mission in Kabul. Peter, the Obama administration is suggesting there might be a negotiated power-sharing arrangement to deliver a new Afghan government instead of the runoff election that was suggested when we spoke to you last. Would that be any more legitimate, a power-sharing arrangement, than this current arrangement is?
There is no legitimate solution to Afghanistan's electoral crisis because the elections were so tainted with fraud. 1.5 million fraudulent ballots have been uncovered by the Electoral Complaints Commission. Up to 3 million ballots may have been fraudulent. So a negotiated solution may be the best that we can do right now to keep peace in the country, but there is no good solution.
Former number two at the United Nations on Afghanistan, Ambassador Peter Galbraith, former diplomat, stay with us. We'll be back to you in just a moment. But first, everything else you need to know this morning.
In the headlines, results from a UN-backed panel on the Afghan election are now out. The review has voided thousands of votes that's supposed to force a runoff. But the country's own election commission says it will not accept the results of that review. White House Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel says there will be no decision on troop levels in Afghanistan until the presidential election there is settled. He also says the new Afghan government must be deemed a, quote, true partner of the U.S.
At this hour, diplomats from Russia, France, and the U.S. are opening talks with Iran on its nuclear program. The U.S. has proposed a plan for Iran's low-enriched uranium, which would go to other countries for processing and then back to Iran for use as fuel in a reactor for peaceful purposes. Reports in Iran state media today say that Tehran is backing away from that plan. An attorney for Richard and Mayumi Heaney says the couple is willing to voluntarily turn themselves in to face any charges stemming from an alleged hoax. A Colorado sheriff says the story that their six-year-old floated away in a giant balloon last week was a publicity stunt. Charges are expected sometime today or tomorrow. Wall Street was down a bit on Friday. The Dow kicks off today at 99.96, back below the 10,000 mark, but probably not for long. The S&P starts trading at 10.88, and the NASDAQ begins at 21.57. Futures trading suggests a positive opening on Wall Street. So from where the wild things are to this cautionary tale in Colorado about Balloon Boy, parenting is very, very public. How do you handle second-guessing or backseat parenting? Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. A frustrating, violent weekend in South Asia, that's for sure. And we begin with a story this morning from our partners, the BBC. Apparently, the count in Afghanistan has now fallen below 50% over fraud concerns, suggesting that an imminent announcement of a runoff is expected out of Afghanistan. But we don't know. They're still disputing the results there in Afghanistan. And let's review the bidding outside of Afghanistan. First of all, they're attempting to fight back against the bloody attacks that took place last week in Iran. An attack on a Revolutionary Guard station in southern Iran. Sunni zealots, 42 people dead in that attack. And all the way from Iran to Afghanistan, you've got an axis of instability. Joining us to discuss all of this morning is Alexander Thier, Director of Afghanistan and Pakistan Policy at the U.S. Institute of Peace. He's on the line from Washington. Good morning, Alex.
Good morning, John.
And rejoining us, Ambassador Peter Galbraith. He was until last month the number two ranking official at the United Nations mission in Kabul. Peter, good morning again.
Good morning, John.
Do I have the map right? Is it fair to say this morning that we are looking at varying degrees of religious instability, ethnic tension from Iran all the way to Pakistan and Afghanistan?
John, there's nothing new about that in that part of the world. Yes, you are. It's likely that the situation in Iran is somewhat separate, but what's going on in Pakistan and Afghanistan are part and parcel of the same problem of these. It is both tribal. It is ethnic, actually the same ethnic group in Pakistan and in Afghanistan, the Pashtuns. And it certainly involves the same religious party, the Taliban, Pakistani Taliban, Afghanistan Taliban, and Al-Qaeda is in precisely the border region between those two countries.
Alex Thier, do you have an analysis of the instability that we saw over the weekend in Iran any differently? Is there something unique about the Iran situation, or are we seeing something spilling over from the Pakistan side of the border?
Well, part of the additional factor in Iran actually has to do with the Baluch ethnic group. There's a group that spans across southern Pakistan, southern Afghanistan, and southern Iran, the Baluch, who for many years, particularly in Pakistan and in Iran, have fought for greater autonomy or even independence. And so you really have this mix not only of sectarianism and the issues of the Pashtun insurgency, but you also have this sort of ethnic nationalism as well that's causing instability.
Well, so Alex Thier, Director of Afghanistan and Pakistan at the U.S. Institute of Peace, and Ambassador Peter Galbraith, formerly with the United Nations in Kabul, you've both described crazy quilt of ethnic and tribal tensions in this entire region. Evaluate for me then what Rahm Emanuel said over the weekend on one of the Sunday talk shows about the possibility of a negotiated power-sharing government in Afghanistan as a solution to the current instability. Listen.
What President Karzai must do, and what I, you know, the process there, is a credible and legitimate election or result, more importantly, for the Afghan people and for that government going forward. Whether that's through a runoff, whether that's through negotiations, the process will be determined by the Afghan people. The result for us and for the president is whether, in fact, there's a credible government and a legitimate process.
Ambassador Peter Galbraith, is Rahm Emanuel suggesting that a power-sharing arrangement is an alternative to a runoff? And if so, does that open the entire can of worms that it's not simply negotiating with Hamid Karzai and Abdullah Abdullah, but you're going to have to negotiate with every tribal ethnic group in Afghanistan to form a credible government there?
I don't think you have to negotiate with every group in Afghanistan to form a credible government. I think there's a separate problem, which is, can Hamid Karzai continue as president of Afghanistan and be seen as credible by a large segment of the Afghan population? This election was so tainted with fraud. At least 1.5 million ballots were fraudulent, maybe as many as 3 million. And now you have the Independent Election Commission, which only the head of the UN mission thought was independent. It was strictly a pro-Karzai body, and it is now rejecting the decision of the Electoral Complaints Commission, which is a body set up under Afghan law. At some point, the crisis just becomes too much, certainly for international support for Afghanistan, and also, I think, for a good part of the Afghan people.
And the bar is really low. Here's Hamid Karzai speaking back in May about his, quite frankly, humble ambitions for the Afghan government, insofar as he even has any control here. Listen.
We're Afghan households, the most important of all. We're Afghan households, when they go to bed at night, are sure that neither the Afghan government nor somebody else, nor terrorists are going to be at their doorsteps to harass them or to take them away, that Afghan life returns to safety and security.
Alex, is there any prospect that Afghanistan can deliver on that very humble pledge, Alex Thier?
Well, I think that that is the root of the problem. When people are faced with insecurity, either because of terrorism, the insurgency, or indeed, as Hamid Karzai suggests, that their own government, which he's led for the last 8 years, is preying upon them, then they're unlikely to enjoy stability. I do believe that stability is possible in Afghanistan, but I am very happy that the White House has so forcefully recognized the fact that they need to deal with the political issues in Afghanistan, certainly before they can effectively deal with the military issues.
So, Ambassador Peter Galbraith, are you suggesting that any government that includes Hamid Karzai will not be legitimate?
I think it's going to be very difficult at this stage, after all that has happened, for Karzai to have much credibility with a significant part of the Afghan population, certainly the Tajiks, which are the second largest group, probably a part of the Hazaras, the third largest group, and even in the Pashtuns, which are the about 45% of the country. There's a lot of there's not much enthusiasm for him. Beyond that, the international effort in Afghanistan requires the idea that we're all fighting for something. And when people perceive, rightly, that it is a corrupt, ineffective government that has clung to power through fraud and by manipulating the rules, that is going to undermine support. And I want to come back to what Rahm Emanuel said. I think the president is exactly right to say we cannot be sending 40,000 additional troops to Afghanistan unless we have a credible partner.
All right, but that's a message for Americans. That's not a message for the Afghan people.
Yes, it is. Right, exactly.
But looking at Afghanistan, Alex Thier, if, as Peter Galbraith suggests, Hamid Karzai has to go and the Obama administration has the political will to actually get him off the political stage in Afghanistan, this is now an occupation. This then becomes a U.S. occupation of Afghanistan and a regime change dictated by Washington, correct? correct?
I don't believe that Washington is going to force Hamid Karzai out. I think that the emphasis right now is trying to build some sort of unity government. I think what really concerns the Afghan people is not just the election. I think that they're bothered by the election and the fraud, but what they're really bothered by is the failure of the Karzai government, as well as the international community, to deliver on 8 years of promises to provide security and the rule of law and development. And I think that if we can begin to demonstrate that we can, in fact, provide those things, because we haven't really been trying that hard during the Bush administration, then I think that the Afghan people will come to accept the government again. So I agree with your premise, John. I think that forcing Karzai out puts us in a very dangerous situation, making us look like occupiers, and that's also not something that we can afford to become more of in Afghanistan.
All right. Thank you, Alex. Ambassador Peter Galbraith, under a minute. Final thought?
First, I want to be clear, I'm not advocating that
right.
the U.S. force Obama out. I'm simply stating an analytic fact that I think Karzai is not going to have credibility, and that's why the situation is much worse. And that really does go to the domestic decision that the president makes about whether to send additional troops, which, absent a credible partner, I don't think makes sense. So not a good use of our very valuable military resources.
Well, Ambassador Peter Galbraith, until last month, the number two ranking official at the United Nations mission in Kabul. Also joining us was Alexander Thier, who's director of Afghanistan and Pakistan at the U.S. Institute of Peace. Thanks to both of you.
That's a story from Afghanistan, but all day we're asking you about a story very much closer to home. When is it okay to second guess a parent?
Never.
It's always easy to do that with the Heenies. Is it always or never?
The Heenies. Now everyone
but
knows.
They brought that in.
You don't even have to say the Heenies in Denver anymore with the Balloon Boy. Everybody knows Heenies.
Balloon Boy and Falcon. But that's the extreme example. But is it okay for someone to give you parenting advice about your screaming child in say, the mall? When does that become a problem? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
Now for some quick takeouts on stories we're following this week. We're going to start with Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. So, Todd, misleading the public, manipulating the media, the biggest issue in Washington and around the country right now. This is what one listener had to say.
This is Talia calling from Boston. Just wanted to follow up on your story about the Balloon Boy. There's a much bigger hoax being played on the American people right now, and that's by the insurance company.
She called into 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can also email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. So, Todd, big hoaxes being played by the insurance company on the American people. I assume they're talking about the ads coming out from insurance company.
According to one listener, yeah. Actually, I've been hiding in my attic the last week. I heard John calling me, but I didn't quite want to come out.
A lot of helium there in Washington,
yeah.
Todd.
Not to mention Mylar. It's all a great combination. Well, yes, great confluence between two stories. The listener from Boston actually agrees with President Obama that there's being a hoax perpetrated by insurance companies. It's a common refrain anytime big healthcare legislation comes up. But, you know, this whole debate got started. The White House had a bunch of unsteady allies, of course. Drug companies ponied up $80 billion in a deal to get a bill going. Hospitals and nursing homes ponied up about $200 billion. And the insurance companies have been on board in an unsteady way. And they had grand bargain the whole time. The grand bargain was we won't deny people anymore for pre-existing conditions, and we won't do rescissions. We won't drop their coverage when they get sick, as long as the taxpayers, you and me, subsidize the insurance of tens of millions of more people, we get more customers. So lower margins, more customers. That was the grand bargain. Deal's fraying a little bit, and the insurance companies, just like in 1994 with Harry and Louise, have started coming out with ads against the Senate bill, or what's shaping up to be the Senate bill, and the president has had quite enough of it. He went on the air on Saturday, his radio internet address, and he had this to say.
This is the unsustainable path we're on, and it's the path the insurers want to keep us on. In fact, the insurance industry is rolling out the big guns and breaking out their massive war chest to marshal their forces for one last fight to save the status quo. They're filling the airwaves with deceptive and dishonest ads. They're flooding Capitol Hill with lobbyists and campaign contributions. and they're funding studies designed to mislead the American people.
Todd, that doesn't sound like a frayed relationship. That sounds like it's severed.
Like it's severed. But we'll see what happens when the bill hits the floor, whether the insurance companies think that this grand bargain has held together. The interesting thing about the rest of what the president had to say, you know, liberal Democrats on the Hill had been throwing out this idea of taking away the antitrust protection that insurance right. companies have, just like baseball. The president hasn't said anything about that until Saturday. He didn't go as far as to say he supports it, but he did say that lawmakers
veiled
are
warning.
Correct for looking into it. That's a shot across the bow. That's what that is.
Todd Zwillig is Takeaway's Washington correspondent. Thanks, Todd.
That would really change the business model for medical insurance. But now our business takeout from not Louise Story, who's away this week, but our good friend Dan Gross, columnist for Newsweek and Slate. Dan, good morning.
Good morning, John.
You know, it's well known that the book publishing industry hasn't made money for maybe decades. But there's something going on with the commodification of books at the retail level between Walmart and Amazon that is maybe good for consumers, but bad for authors.
Yeah, absolutely. Late last week, this price war flared up. Walmart, which has a big website, is trying to get more people to buy stuff there, said that it would sell 10 hot new books, you know, James Patterson, Sarah Palin, you know, some of these blockbuster books. It would sell them for $10 a piece if you pre-order on its website. Amazon came out and said, we will match that. Then Walmart said, hey, we're going to cut it down to $9. And then they cut it down to $8.99 after Amazon matched Walmart again. What we're seeing here is a couple things. Amazon and Walmart are kind of duking it out, not just on books, on kind of retail, online retail stuff generally. But the real issue of concern here is that the wholesale price of those books, like Sarah Palin's Going Rogue,
right.
is going to be $15 or so. So basically you have these giant companies saying they are willing to lose $4 and $5 on every sale of these books for the sake of maybe getting a little market share.
Is this less about books and more about the ultimate battle at the OK Corral of retail for market share between Amazon and Walmart, who are huge in their own way?
For Amazon and Walmart, this is not particularly about books. It could have been about anything. It's just that these are a highly visible product. They are a big gift item. We're gearing up for the Christmas holiday season, and of course, those of us in the word trade tend to follow what happens with, you know, this small industry with a sort of obsession, because many of us, you know, are trying to sell our own books.
Right, exactly. And someone else named Dan is a pretty big bestseller there over at Walmart. Not Dan Gross. Dan, what's his name?
White?
No, no.
Green?
No.
Brown?
No. There you go.
There you go.
Dan Gross, columnist for Newsweek and Slate, Westport, Connecticut. Thanks for our takeout there on Amazon and Walmart fighting over books.
And now we'll go to our sports contributor, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. So we saw the classic showdown, Game 2 of the American League Championship, the New York Yankees and the Los Angeles Angels on Saturday night.
Cut on and grounded toward the hole. Grabbed and throw to second. Throws it away. Going to a third. Scoring is Heston. Yankees win. The Yankees win.
John Sterling.
Very exciting. It was actually a very exciting game. It was 13 innings, and they just squeaked it out. The Yankees won 4-3.
It was like a five-hour game.
Yeah.
There's a couple things I want to tell you about this. A-Rod has been playing amazing baseball. He hit a game-tying home run in the bottom of the 11th inning with two outs and two strikes on him. It was 0-2 was the count, and then he cranked this home run, the opposite field home run. The key thing about A-Rod is that he admits that he's a steroid user. He breaks up with his wife, and he admits that he's a bad husband.
He cheated
exactly. But what he did is that he lifted that veil off of himself, and now he's allowed to be himself, and he's allowed to play. He's allowed to actually be honest, and I think that that's what's behind
his
performance.
Are you his therapist? That's a good gig. That's a good gig. Well, he certainly won. All is forgiven in October in New York. That's right.
Absolutely. When the Yankees are in the playoffs.
Everyone loves A-Rod, exactly.
It's fine. So the Yankees are now ahead in the series, and they've got Game 3 coming up tonight. What do we expect to see?
Well, you have Jared Weaver on the mound for the Angels, and Jared Weaver has a 2.9 ERA, and he's 9-3 at home. So they're in at Los Angeles, so he's going to be really tough to hit tonight. And then you also have going against Andy Pettitte. Andy Pettitte has 15 wins in a postseason for his career.
And he looked huge the last time he was
exactly.
up.
Exactly. So he's a very experienced pitcher. So it's going to be a great game, and the weather will clearly be a lot better than it was in New York.
Phillies 11, Dodgers zip.
What happened to my Dodgers?
There was a guy named Hiroki Kuruda who's the pitcher for the Dodgers. The problem is that the night before, or a couple nights before, when they had put Pedro Martinez on the mound, he hadn't pitched in about a month, and they were like, "Well, let's give Pedro the ball," and Pedro pitched a jewel of a game. So you're like, "Okay," the Dodgers are like, "Let's put our guy who hasn't pitched in a month on the mound," and he pitched not a jewel of the game. He actually pitched a lump of coal of the game.
Okay, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports contributor. Obviously, we're going to continue to watch that. The Phillies and the Dodgers tonight at 8 o'clock, and we'll see what happens with the Yankees and the Angels as well.
Interstate Bowl. I mean, I-95 World Series, that's what we're talking about.
That's right.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Okay, John, I'm trying to come up with a reasonable alternative to just saying balloon boy all the time, but you're not buying dirigible male child, right?
No. Media frenzy, you know. Seizure activity, you know, whatever you want to call it.
All right. Well, we're going to be talking more about Balloon Boy and what this says about kids on reality TV.
Goody.
Sorry. Here's some of the news stories we're following now at 32 minutes past the hour. Fraud investigators have thrown out hundreds of thousands of ballots for Afghan President Hamid Karzai in the country's disputed election. A United Nations-backed panel released its findings this morning after nearly 2 months of investigations. The report sets the stage for a runoff. Meanwhile, the White House says it will not make a decision on troop levels in Afghanistan until the election is settled. Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel gave CBS a list of things that need to happen there.
Get a government that is seen as legitimate to the people and has a credibility to be a partner in the effort to secure Afghanistan so it's not a haven for al-Qaeda or other type of terrorists or international terrorist organizations.
Emanuel says it would be reckless to make a decision on troops now.
The Justice Department is reversing a Bush administration policy on medical marijuana. Today, federal prosecutors will be told not to pursue pot-smoking patients or their suppliers in states where medical marijuana is legal. Screening technique can double the chance of success for in vitro fertilization. Researchers from Oxford University are reporting the results of an ongoing study with great confidence at a fertility meeting today. And those are some of the stories that we're following this morning.
Go for nothing less. Spread your wings and fly away.
It may be a surprise to few people in the United States, but the Denver police are saying that it was all a hoax.
It has been determined that this is a hoax, that it was a publicity stunt. We believe that we have evidence at this point to indicate that it was a publicity stunt done with the hopes of marketing themselves or better marketing themselves for a reality television show at some point in the future.
That's Larimer County Sheriff Jim Alderden speaking at a press conference. So joining us today to talk about this issue is Kate Daly. She's the health and lifestyle editor for Newsweek.com. We've also got Liz Gumbinner, publisher of Mom 101, a parenting blog that includes personal stories from her own family. And Kate, let me ask you first. This is by the very phrase publicity stunt, we're talking about a mom and a dad, if these allegations are true, who wanted the world to come and watch their family.
Right. And like you said, we don't know a lot about, you know, we know what the allegations are. We know that the family has come out and said this is not a hoax. There have been some people affiliated with the story coming forward saying I helped him plan this or they would never do this. So all we know is that it's kind of creepy and sordid.
Since when is a publicity stunt illegal in America of all places? I mean, this publicity stunts, this is like the whole nation.
I think is when you start involving federal officials and taxpayer money, that's when it gets a little creepy. I mean, that's when the illegality comes in. And also, but I think people have less problem with the idea that it was a big waste of government money and time than the fact that they're maybe dragging these kids into something that they're not necessarily equipped to handle.
And that's really the question, because if to a certain extent, all reality TV drags kids. Really, John and Kate plus 8, do those kids have no choice whether or not to have their family featured on national television and talked about on People magazine?
Right.
And Kate's come out and said, you know, my kids love doing the show and they were so sad when it was over and it's so good for them. But you know what? Kids would love drinking antifreeze if they had the chance, and that's not good for them either. And so kids can't really be the arbiter of whether or not they should be on TV.
Liz Gumbinner, she's the publisher of Mom 101. And on this blog, you actually describe personal details about your family and about your kids. And I assume you do not ask your children to look over your blog before you publish it.
Well, I did, but as infants, they had trouble responding to me. I think as a memoirist, which is what I am, I have an obligation to tell my truth. And particularly when the story is about the journey into new motherhood, having an infant or a toddler plays into that. That said, I think that as our children become older and have their own identities and their own reputations, really, we have an obligation to look at the boundaries and at what point.
What do you mean by older? How old do you have to be as a child before you start having a right to privacy?
Well, my oldest daughter right now is 4, and I'm already starting to see a difference in how I'm describing things. I certainly don't want to scar her for life. I'll do it in other ways, but rather not do it through my blogging.
But don't you invite public criticism and sort of you know people to second guess you as a parent once you go public on any level, whether it's a reality show or this insane Heaney family?
Of course. And the reality is I'm more concerned about how the fellow moms in my Brooklyn preschool are judging my cookies at the bake sale than how anonymous strangers on the internet might be judging my parenting.
That's some pressure. That's some pressure.
Moms are always judged. Strangers love coming up to moms in the street and saying, you know, telling you how to get your kid to stop crying or telling you what you're doing wrong about parenting. There was an article in the New York Times this weekend about Michael Chabon and Aliet Waldman, who are, you know, this literary power couple. They write about their kids, and while the article was pretty, complimentary, which again kind of speaks to how the medium is the message. So if you're Michael Chabon, you're this sort of revolutionary writer, and if you're a mommy blogger, you're putting your kids up for intense scrutiny.
I wonder if there is a trade-off. I think maybe we've decided in America that it's all public, that all this family stuff is public, and that basically people have the right and the invitation to come to you and say, you know, what you're doing with your son.
I don't buy that at all. Kate, do you buy that?
Well, you know, I think it raises an interesting point because there are so many, you know, but where before it would just be Michael Chabon writing about his kids, now we've got hundreds of thousands
of bloggers like Liz.
And so now when you grow up, it's not like there's going to be one kid in the class who had that embarrassing story about him on the internet. They're all going to have embarrassing stories.
The whole class is a reality.
But Liz, here's my question to you. Your daughter's 4 years old. She's going to be going to kindergarten next year. So you're going to go to a party at your child's kindergarten class, and some mom is going to walk up and bring up something that was on the blog and take you to task over it.
They already do all the time. They don't take
you're
me to task for it.
You're okay with that.
Yes, because I think I make good decisions about my children and how I want to portray them. And that's the difference between blogging and reality TV.
And there's nothing illegal. I mean, I think the problem I have with this whole Colorado story is like, okay, maybe the Heaneys aren't the best parents in the world, but do we want Larimer County Sheriff Jim Alderson being the parent now, this like goofy sheriff who couldn't figure out there wasn't a kid in the balloon?
Well, I had a real problem when they said, you know, we went in with Child and Protective Services. We thought there might be some abuse, but there was no evidence for us to be able to take the kids out. I'm like, well, then why are you talking about how you tried to take the kids away if it turned out that the parents were fit in that capacity? I mean, I think the problem that parents have is when they think that they should be paid for exposing their kids' privacy. I think you have to realize that privacy is the new currency. People are giving it away for free. And so when you try to, you know, exploit kids for reality TV that way, that's when you're going to get in trouble.
And I think there's a big difference between sharing your stories with the community versus exploiting your children for fame and fortune.
So I guess that's the takeaway. Once money's involved, it's
bad. You'd say yes to a book deal, right, Liz?
Yes, I would.
Of course, there we go.
But I hopefully wouldn't have to fake my child floating away in a balloon to get one.
Liz Gumbinner is the publisher of Mom 101. That's a parenting blog. We were also joined by Kate Daly, a friend of the program, health and lifestyle editor for Newsweek.com.
But I think, you know, that whole conversation was missing something.
What?
The sound of people's voices when they breathe helium. I think that's what it really needed.
Talk like this.
John,
Liz Gumbinner.
You're a unique individual.
That's really, but in many ways, that's a good thing.
I think this entire story has missed people talking through helium breath. I think so.
I'm totally speechless. And for me, that's an achievement.
Yes, if you would like to talk through helium, call us at 877-8MYTAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Ignore the man sitting next to me.
I'm Stella from Detroit.
Don't do that. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. Imagine a landing of an aircraft that caused everyone to cheer. No charges were filed, and it only took like 200 seconds, not hours and hours.
Balloon boy again?
No, I'm talking about U.S. Airways pilot who safely landed his plane in the Hudson with 135 passengers, Captain Chesley Sullenberger, just released an autobiography. Captain Sullenberger, good morning.
Hello, John. Hi, Celeste. Thanks for having me.
You know, it's hard enough to land on the Hudson River, but giving advice to people based on your experience as a pilot, that seems like even more difficult task.
Well, I actually, my first bit of advice is a bit more easy to take. I think if you're going to land an airplane in the Hudson River and get this much attention focused on you, you better already have married a very smart, well-spoken woman like I did.
Nice. All right, that's good. I'm writing that one down.
Okay, but yeah, this was a very personal story. It was important for me to write the book. I think it helped me process it and put it in perspective, but it also helped answer a question for me, and that was, what was it about this remarkable event that captured the imaginations of so many people around the world? And what I came up with is that it happened at a time when people desperately needed good news and a reason to feel hopeful again, when it seemed like everything was going wrong.
But everyone gets on a plane, and everyone believes when they buy that plane ticket that the pilot is going to take care of them. I mean, whether they say it, whether they've had a conversation about it at all, they believe that you guys can do it all. And you proved it. So in a sense, you pushed sort of a button that's in everybody.
Well, I also go into great detail of things that haven't been heard before about how I made those important decisions in just seconds. You know, Jeff and I only had 208 seconds from the time we hit the berth until we landed. But you're right. I guess part of my message is that the profession of the airline pilot is a very important one, and it's hard. It's not easy. If it were easy, anybody could do it. But that's clearly not the case, and it requires years of work and dedication, tens of thousands of hours of practice to have the kind of judgment that comes only from experience, and that's what we need to remember.
Yeah, you're using your fame at this point to push for better pay for pilots and better training.
You know, within a day or two after we landed in the Hudson, and we weren't, Jeff and I, my first officer that day, weren't watching the media. We were busy preparing for our interviews with the investigators. When people began to report to us just how huge this story had become and how many lives it had touched, we felt an intense obligation to do everything we could to further aviation safety, to help our profession in every way we could for as long as we could.
Captain, before we go, it's 208 seconds, is that right?
Yes.
Okay, when in that 208 seconds did you believe that water would be landable?
I felt, based on my experience, that it was possible.
From the beginning?
I didn't initially intend to land on the river. I first considered trying to land on a runway, but it wasn't possible. But based on my experience, I knew I could do it, and I was confident that if I achieved the parameters I wanted to, the airplane would remain intact and float, and people would survive.
Anything about the way the water looked out your window that said, we're going to be fine?
Well, it certainly looked cold, but I knew if I could keep from hitting too hard, then we would all get out okay. And we worked very hard. My intense focus the last minute of the flight was only on controlling the flight path and making that work out.
Well, congratulations to you. Of course, we all know why you're famous, but the story behind it is the subject of Highest Duty, My Search for What Really Matters, the book autobiography of Captain Chesley Sullenberger. Thanks so much, Captain.
Thank you, John Celeste.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. Coming up, we're going to talk with Elizabeth Warren. She's watching over the bailout money in Washington, and a new report says foreclosures are rising. It's a disturbing trend. We're going to talk about it in just a moment. We're also talking about backseat parenting. It's easy to do with parents like the very public Heaneys, but when is it okay and not for, when is it okay for non-TV parents, all right?
Bring your kid in the mall. Yes, parents probably, it shouldn't hurt them at all, get some advice from somebody else. If this child is screaming in the mall, then obviously they need some help.
Give us your take. Life is a reality show, isn't it, folks? 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Right now, here's a check on leading stories at 48 minutes after the hour. A United Nations-backed panel looked into election fraud in Afghanistan and says Hamid Karzai did not receive enough votes for an outright win. The country's own election commission, which our partner the BBC says is widely seen as pro-Karzai, says it won't accept the results of this review. Meanwhile, the head of NATO says that all member states should endorse General Stanley McChrystal's recommendation to send more troops to Afghanistan. Yesterday, White House Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel says the U.S. won't make a decision until the election is settled.
David Lane, an attorney for Richard and Mayumi Heaney, is speaking out. He says even if the balloon incident was a hoax, it's not child abuse.
That is for social services to determine. Putting their kids on TV, you know, there's certainly plenty of worse cases of child abuse.
Lane spoke on NBC. Officials allege it was a hoax to land a reality TV show's charges are expected sometime today. Those are some of the news stories that we're watching.
Well, when we have questions about the financial bailout, we go to Elizabeth Warren, who's the chairperson of the Congressional Oversight Panel. She's joining us in a moment, but let's remind you, the financial bailout was supposed to accomplish one basic goal, right? To keep banks functioning well enough so that credit would be available for businesses and consumers. Well, the government panel that oversees the management of TARP, that's Elizabeth Warren's committee, the Toxic Asset Relief Program Oversight Committee, is questioning the Treasury Department's plans for reducing foreclosures in general and for making credit more available to home buyers in specifics. To explain is Elizabeth Warren, who joins us from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Good morning, Elizabeth Warren.
Good morning.
Now, 1 in 8 mortgages currently in foreclosure or default, that translates to about 10 to 12 million consumers affected. What does that say about the ability of the TARP fund to make credit available for home buyers and to tide them over in these difficult times?
Well, it says two things. It says that it's been slow, and it also says that it may not be directed to the right target group of homeowners who are in trouble. We're very concerned that the program that has been developed, in fact, focuses on subprime mortgages, which was the problem 6 months ago. But as you know, the problem today is that the foreclosures have spilled over into the prime market and are now driving the foreclosure wave.
And indeed may affect the financial institutions. We'll talk about that in a moment. But let me introduce you to someone. Do you mind, Elizabeth?
No, please do.
Yeah, Elizabeth Warren, meet Brian Murphy, who's the Director of Hospitality Services and the father of three from St. Paul, Minnesota. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning.
Now, Brian, would you like to explain to myself, Celeste, and Elizabeth Warren the troubles you've been having trying to maintain your mortgage and get the credit markets to deal with you?
Yeah, I'll try to summarize my journey, but ultimately, my loan originated through Countrywide as the result of attempting to get out of a subprime balloon arm mortgage about 4 years ago. Ended up landing back into a kind of an extended balloon, a 10-year scenario with Countrywide. Anticipated the payments were higher. You know, my goal was to save the home, keep my family in the home. Started falling behind, ran into trouble. My wife was in and out of steady employment for a period of time, and ultimately I got to the point where I started raising my hand back in December of 2008, attempting to get some attention and some assistance. Hit it hard in March of 2009.
Okay.
And I've been going at that since.
And what's been the response of the federal government?
Dealing directly with Bank of America, it has been all over the road.
All right. Well, let's put this directly to Elizabeth Warren. The Making Home Affordable Program, which is a part of what you're overseeing there on the Congressional Oversight Panel, is that program supposed to help people like Brian Murphy, who is employed, who has a family, who apparently has some difficulties with his wife and is trying to stay in his home?
Well, at least it should be aimed in that direction. But remember, the program is largely structured around the voluntary participation of the mortgage lenders and their servicers. And I think it's fair to say they have done a very bad job. I wish Brian's story were unique, but I hear or read Brian's story many, many times every day. They simply are not doing the job that needs to be done.
So let me get this straight then, and Brian, chime in, please.
Yes. It
sounds like what we did was we passed a program which created a mandate to bail out the banks. That means it was a matter of law to give money to the banks, but it's up to the banks voluntarily to decide whether to lend to you, Brian?
That's my understanding, and my understanding is that Bank of America is participating in that that voluntary program. Yet nobody within their organization is aware of what they need to do to start implementing that.
And Brian is saying it exactly right. They are a participant. In fact, we could make a whole list here of all of the financial institutions who say, we're participating. It's just that the stories we're hearing from the other end, when people call, there's no one on the other end of the phone who seems to know what's going on and is able to move people
through the process.
Well, Elizabeth, the legislature is now considering expanding and putting more money into banks to help homeowners. And I'm wondering, we're hearing all kinds of complaints about the banks, that number one, that they're not giving out credit. Number two, that they're opposing reforms and still paying people too much. So before we start giving them even more money for more mortgages, how do we control this to the extent that the money actually gets to people like Brian where it's supposed to go?
Well, you know, right now, the problem is not one of inadequate money. The TARP fund has set aside, the Treasury has set aside $50 billion of TARP money and spent only a tiny fraction of it. So long as people like, you know, Bank of America, as long as institutions like Bank of America are not answering the phone on the other end or helping people like Brian, they actually don't get any money from the federal government for this. So I think this is really more program design than it is money, at least at this moment in time.
So $50 billion, how much of that do you need, Brian, to stay in your house? Probably not even a whole billion, right?
No, sir.
All right, so I guess let's talk program design for a moment. It sounds like Bank of America is permitted, in fact, even encouraged, to cherry-pick mortgage lenders on the basis of credit rating and ease and ability to pay, and ditch people like Brian Murphy and go to the federal government and say, we're being responsible bankers. We're making prudent lending decisions by not answering the phone when Brian Murphy calls.
Well, I don't think they would put it that way.
Probably not.
There seems to be some evidence in that direction.
So what do we do about it? You're the oversight panel.
Well, the best we can do is exactly what we have done. We've put out a long report showing the data. We've held hearings on this. And quite frankly, we keep thumping on Treasury, hoping that the consequence will be that Treasury will thump on the mortgage lender.
But so far that hasn't worked. The hearings and the reports have done nothing to change the behavior of the banks.
Well, give us a little time. Our report has only been out for a week and a half now. So we are pushing in this direction, but I understand the frustration every single day that goes by. People are losing their homes in foreclosure. People who, according to the programs that we have designed, should be able to save their homes. And that's
It's not happening.
The delays are catastrophic for these families. I mean, I completely understand the point.
Well, sympathy there. And I guess, as you say, it's going to take some time for this report to work its way through the system. Elizabeth Warren joining us from Cambridge, Massachusetts, chair of the Congressional Oversight Panel. Brian Murphy, when does the clock run out for you?
You know, December 11th.
Wow.
I was just notified last week in the middle of the process. So, yeah, it's... pretty sad.
Oh, just in time for the holiday season. Well, we'll be in touch with you before then. Brian Murphy is a director of hospitality services at a business in St. Paul, Minnesota. He's the father of three, struggling to stay in his home in St. Paul.
Well, we've been talking about families all day today. Some of them, like Brian Murphy's, are realistically troubled. Some of them, like the Heaneys, possibly invited the trouble to themselves. And we're asking you, the thing that all these stories have in common is parenting. So if you are the parent of a wild boy, number one, how do you deal with wild boys? And number two, would you expose your kids to reality TV? We've been getting your stories about this.
This is Lillian from Washington State. There's nothing more boring than to listen to other people talk about how they take care of their kids. Forget it.
I guess that's somebody who's not going to be giving advice because she doesn't want to hear about it. Tell us what you think at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org. We're also going to be holding a chili cook-off coming up soon, and we want your tried-and-true recipe. It's a recession, so make sure you make it on the cheap. You can email that to mytakeatthetakeaway.org.
I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org. See ya.